So welcome for our next lecture on program optimization. Last time we have looked at consent propagation. And as a very brief recap, consent propagation, so the idea is we try to determine values of variables and values of program expressions statically before running the program. And so we wonder, the goal is to determine the values of variables which are attained independent of the program execution taken at runtime. And so that was essentially what we did, is we kind of implemented the ordinary semantics of the program, only that we extended the domain of values with a dedicated value top, which indicated that the value is unknown, and we also extended we also introduced a value bottom to indicate that the program point is not reachable at all. And with these two extensions, we could introduce transformations for control flow edges, and we could put up a constraint system, and hopefully we'll be able to solve that. Now then, we wanted to know how can we make sure that what we do is gives us reliable information about the semantics of the program. And for that, the idea was to introduce a description relation between concrete states and abstract states. And then we wanted to establish that this description relation is preserved when performing a single step of the program. And a single step is, in the concrete semantics, you traverse the control flow edge, you update the program state, or you inspect the variables and have a discard instead. So that was what you do in the concrete world. And then you also have to do something in the abstract world, and there was a kind of an abstract evaluation and an abstract update of states. So the concrete and the abstract semantics have quite the same structure, only that they operate on different kind of values. And in order to, therefore, it seems natural to us that that this description relation is preserved by every step. But if we want to make it formal, we may go step by step. So first we may look at expressions. So we can evaluate an expression over concrete values. This gives us, say, a number, and we can evaluate it in the abstract. And that will give us a number or top, and it will so the goal is to infer, given that the row and the d are in a description relation, that then also the values of expressions will be in this description relation. So this is the preservation of the description relation in that particular case, and since there are many expressions, we do not want to look at each expression separately, but we can do an induction over the structure of the expression, and that for that we only require that this super duper property holds, namely that the concrete evaluation of operators and the abstract operation somehow preserve the description relation. And that is this yellow thing. We have to check for each operator and how we define it in the abstract and how it is defined in the concrete. And typically one uses this yellow thing not as a proof obligation, but a kind of as a specification. So you define your nice operators here in such a way that this relation is satisfied. And then you get for free, so to speak, that this property holds, that his expressions are in that expression evaluation preserves the description relation. And now let us see how that helps us to So then the rest of the proof somehow is more or less automatic. So let us see. The most interesting case is the case where we have an assignment. And so we assume that we have before the assignment, the program state, the concrete one, and the abstract one are in the description relation. So in the concrete world, the program state consists of a variable assignment and the information about the memory. And in the abstract world, we ignore the memory, and so the D only speaks about the program variables. Yeah. And so in order to be in description relation, this D should be different from bottom. So that is the thing, because bottom was assumed to be to describe nothing. So therefore, if we have a pair in relation, this D is different from bottom, and that means it's a variable assignment. Something which assigns to each variable a value or top. Okay? So that therefore, accordingly, we know now that the D is of that form. And now that means for such a D, we can do expression evaluation in the abstract, and we can do expression evaluation for the original row in the concrete. And then we know if the D and the row are in description relation, then the result of the expression evaluation also will be in this description relation. So this means if in the concrete you get 5, then in the abstract which values are possible only? In the concrete you get the value 5. What might the abstract evaluation return? An abstract value which describes 5. So this could be 5, or it could be top. Top means I don't know. And in most of the cases, it will be simply top. But it cannot be 3. So abstract evaluation will never, that would be a wrong result. Yeah, but if it's 5, then it's the precise value. And if it's top, then we have given up, we failed. Yeah? So that is what you should see here. So if you see, since the D is and the row are in the description relation, if we get, this means that if we get 5 here, then here we will have 5 or top. One of them will occur. And then now it means, that means if the row here, the concrete, will be updated with the value x will receives the value 5, and in the abstract x will either also receive the value 5 or will receive the value top if we failed. But still, these two values, the concrete one, the concrete 5, or the value which abstract evaluation of the expression returned, will be in the description relation. Therefore, if row and D were before in this description relation, they will also be in this description relation afterwards. And that's what we want to prove. That shows that the description relation is preserved. Okay, so I made a lot of words about something which is perhaps even quite obvious to you. Yeah? But that would be kind of the formal argument. Okay, so we see now, okay, that worked out fine, and that was the key step, that the assignment works. And now for the other things, this is, we have to check it, but I would guess it's easier. So for example, for the reading from memory. For the reading from memory is very easy. In the concrete world, you have this, the reading from memory will update the row in putting x and some value for the variable x. Now in our abstract world, we have bad luck because we don't know what is in the memory, so therefore we will put top to x. But any value, say 5, is described by top. So therefore, if row and D were in the description relation, afterwards they also will be in the description relation because at the particular value x, we have 5 and top. This is fine. And for all other variables, nothing has changed. So therefore, row and D are still afterwards in the description relation. And that is what we had to prove. Okay? You got it? So now let's see what happens if we write to memory. Write to memory, not read, so I should put the stress on that. We write to memory, but that means that the local state does not change, and the D also does not change. So therefore, everything is fine. only the memory changes, but the abstract evaluation does not take care of that, so it ignores it. So therefore, it's fine. Okay, so now it's now comes another interesting case where we have to be a little bit careful. That is, and where we could have made mistakes in our when designing the analysis for the guards. So for that we have to assume we have a so what do we have to prove? What is our proof obligation? So we have a we have a state S before, and assume we have the state afterwards is also S. So that means the guard was taken. That means E was true in the concrete. So this means in the concrete we obtained that zero, that the evaluation of E returned the value zero. Okay? So now we have, but we have, here is an expression which is evaluated. This expression we can also evaluate in the abstract. In the abstract we return a value, we don't know whether we will get zero in the abstract. But we will not be, never, definitely never will obtain the value 1 in the abstract, because the description relation is preserved. So the results obtained by the abstract evaluation either will be also 0 or will be top. And what did we do in this case? In this case, so this will be the situation which we will have in the abstract. And in this situation, we said intuitively, okay, we cannot exclude that that edge is taken, so therefore the abstract successor state will be D. And that's the same. That's the same as, so D is the same, so in this case D1, the successor state, is the same as D. And that means, since here we started out with a successor state which is equal to the predecessor state and in the concrete, and that we also have in the abstract, and therefore the description relation is preserved. Okay, so this was if it is taken. If it is not taken, we do not have to say anything about it, because then we don't have a successor state in the concrete. Yeah? Now for the positive thing, so now if, again, we only have a successor state, only if we have a successor state, we have to prove something. If there's no successor state, we do not have to prove anything. So, because bottom is, this is less or equal to anything. So now look at the positive guard. Again, we only have to consider the situation when this edge is taken in the concrete. So in this case, again, the successor state is the same as the predecessor state. So the row 1 and the mu 1 are the same as the pair is the same as the state S before the guard. Now, when is this taken? So this means that in the concrete, the evaluation of E has returned something which is different from zero. So it is 1, 2, 3, or minus 1, 2, minus 2, minus 3, something. Something like that. Now, again, so we don't know what the abstract evaluation will return. The only thing which we know for sure, that the description relation is preserved. So if there's, so that this, these two values are in description relation. So there are, and then that means, now we may look, we may check what happens with that value. So it could be 5. Okay, if it's 5, then we know for sure that it is not 0, and therefore that the edge is taken. Or it is top. So then we also know, okay, it, the edge is taken, maybe taken. In both cases, we kind of the only thing which we really can exclude is that this situation may happen. So that I should perhaps so that will never happen. Why? Because the value abstract evaluation of the expression will return something which describes the value returned by the concrete evaluation, and if it were 0, then that means that in the concrete we also would definitely have 0, and that is definitely not the case. So therefore 0 is the The only value which we can definitely exclude from the abstract interpretation of E, and therefore, in this case, according to our definition, the successor state would be a D1, which is the same as D. So therefore we have that, and since there we have D1, there is a description. Since D describes the variable assignment in S, D describes row 1, and D is equal to D1, and so therefore D1 also describes the row 1. And that's ultimately the thing which we had to prove. So that means simply the description. So in summary, again, we have that the description relation is preserved. And so you see the proof is essentially looking at the definition, staring at the definition, and see whether it is we did the definitions right. So from that we can, from that again, so we may look at, go back. So from that we obtained that this one is, we looked at all possible edges essentially, and so we found that this rectangle here kind of commutes. Either I go, if I go there, this is the same as if I go there, and I have a description relation here, then I have also this description relation here. And that again allows us then, by putting these kind of rectangles one at another, we in the end obtain that this commutation or this preservation also holds not only for individual edges but for all paths. This follows by induction. And that, having established that, we thus now can look at the MOP solution of the constraint system. So that means we take all the paths starting at some initial state, with initial abstract state, which is this, what should we use as initial state, abstract state. So initially, variables can have any value, so therefore we can consider a variable assignment mapping every variable to top. So this is this D top. And then we now do these abstract transformations corresponding to every path, reaching a program point V, applying that to this initial state, and then take the least upper bound of all the variable assignments which we obtain. This is the merge over all paths solution of this constant propagation business. And now, by our this preservation property we have, for every state S, for every initial state S, where the program execution starts, if I apply the path pi to it and do the transformation according to it, and if that is defined and returns some value, the yellow value on the left hand side, then this is described by if I do this thing in an abstract way, for some abstract state which describes S, but this D top definitely describes S. Why? D top has top for everything, so that describes clearly every concrete variable assignment. So therefore, this the yellow thing is in description relation with that. And this one is less or equal to this one. Yes, because this is just a single path, and here I take all paths and take the least upper bound. So this is an upper bound to any of these values down there. So therefore, and now since the description relation is preserved, if I get a larger thing, so ultimately I have that whatever happens at the whatever state I will obtain at the end of my path pi in the concrete, this will be described by the variable assignment returned by the MOP solution. Okay? And that means if I have 5 here, for if X is mapped to 5 here, then I know the value in the concrete will have something where X also must be this mapped to 5. So in that sense, constant propagation returns reliable information. Now, so the, this now comes, so we are, so constant propagation, the dream of the of constant propagation would be to determine this MOP solution. And now comes, okay, so, but now please recall that we never computed the MOP solution directly. All what we did was computing these fixed point things. This constraint, putting up constraint system, doing round robin iteration, computing a thing by that. This we can do. And then, but then we always had the situation, if the transformations all are distributive, then this is the same. And if it's not distributive, then at least we get something larger. So getting something larger is erring on the safe side, because that means that this would be, if D is the solution which we get by solving the fixed point equation, the constraint system, then that would be return a value, which is again even a little bit larger, so but it, we again, it is still on the safe side, on the safe side. That means if we have x equals x, if x maps to 5 here, then this would still mean that x maps to 5 here. Yeah? Only that it is more often, it might be more often the case that x, that our analysis will only find that x maps to top. And then, okay, if x maps to top, we make no claim about the value of x, and so that is definitely always correct. Okay, so so now let's see how we would do this constraints solving thing. So here is this little program. It's again the factorial program. I hope you are not too bored about it. But since it's always the same control flow graph, I do not have to explain it to you. You know it. That's the only advantage of that, because we will find, I promise you, we will find out nothing. We will find out nothing. So here is how the analysis would proceed. So we do round robin iteration. That means we order the broken points in some way. So here is I have the numbering on the left hand in the picture on the left hand side, and then we proceed from one broken point to the other. So first at broken point zero, here I list x and y. So these are the only broken variables. So here at broken point zero. Okay, so this is the start point. There we start with this D index top. So this is top for X, top for Y. So proceeding to program point 1, X receives the value of 10. So therefore we record it. So therefore at program point 1 in the first iteration, we will assign 10 to X. So then we proceed to program point 2. So program point 2, so we have not yet obtained a value for here, for that. So that is still has the value bottom. So this is the initial value for every broken point from where the iteration starts. So that is the contribution to 2 consists of two parts. Sum, the knob operation applied to bottom. So this is bottom. So there's no contribution from broken point 5 yet, but there is a contribution from broken point 1. From broken point 1, we get along this control flow edge that y receives the value 1. So therefore we get the value 1, 10, 1 now at broken point 2. Then we proceed to broken point 3. Yes. Is it the case that x is greater than 1? Okay, this is the case. So therefore we go there and we copy the variable assignment from broken point 2. Then we proceed to broken point 4. And that means at broken point 4, so now maybe I wipe out some things which are that do not no longer matter. So I said we proceed to broken point 4, and that is we have to update y with x times y. 10 times 1 is 10, so therefore now at broken point 4 we have 10. Then we proceed to broken point 5. X must be decremented. So this is 5, 10. Then we proceed to broken point 6. So 6 is So I have to evaluate the guard x greater than 1 for the current value of program at program point 2. So x is 10 at program point 2 for the moment, and therefore 10 is greater than 1, so therefore it is not true that it is false. So therefore this edge is not taken, because this is the negative guard. So therefore I have bottom for program point 6 and bottom for program point 7. Now you wonder, what? Program point 6 is not reachable? Program point 7? It is reachable, but that was only the first iteration of the round robin iteration. So now we have to do the next round. So here's the next round. In the next round, at program point 0, still top. At program point 1, it's the same. We again get 10 for x and top for y. But now comes a decisive difference. We now again reevaluate the value for program point 2. One contribution from program point 1 is where y receives the value 1. But now there's another, so there's this contribution, and there's this contribution from program point 5. And for program point 5, we have that x has the value 9 and y has the value 10. And so we have to do the least upper bound of 10 for x and 1 for y according to one edge, and the other one is 9 for x and and 10 for y. And the least upper bound of these two things will be, okay, least upper bound of 10 and 9 is top for x, and least upper bound of 1 and 10 for y is also top. Too bad. So this means we have, we get top for both x and y at program point 2. Now this might be depressing but it is, thinking a little bit about it, this information is exactly what is, so it is simply, you can't do better, because it's really the case that at program point 2 you will have different values for x and you will have different values for y. Yeah, it is only in the first iteration that x definitely is 10. Later it will be 9, 8, 7, and so on. So that is, the compiler cannot rely on that x has always the same value there. So therefore top is the perfectly adequate answer there, and the same holds true for y. Okay? Also, from an analyzer's perspective, it is completely depressing, because we get no information for program point 2. And this propagates then to program point 3, 4, and 5. Because for program point 3, okay, you go the guard, but the guard still, x may be positive, so therefore you traverse it and then get the info, and then have top there. And then you update x, y with a product of two values. Both of them are unknown, and the product of unknown values will be unknown. So therefore, at program point 4 we have the value top, and at program point 5 it's the same, because then x is decremented, but if it is, we don't know the value, so decrementing it will not improve the value, so therefore it is still top. Okay? So that in the end, and then we are done. So then fixed point iteration has terminated. So the result is completely depressing, but it is simply, we can't hope for something better. So is that, can you follow? And that it indicates that the method is reasonable. Well, in this situation we didn't find out anything. In other examples we might find out something. And so here the only interesting thing is that at that point here, at program point 1, x has a definite value, namely 10. So that is always the case. So that means, although we compute with concrete values, we fail. This does not mean that we kind of find out everything. So that is in fact in many cases we find out nothing. So I might comment a little bit on that. One more sentence, sorry for dealing with such a stupid example for so long, but one issue is if you hand over that program to GCC and you turn on the highest optimization level, then definitely this loop will disappear and it will directly write something to memory. And the reason is that they do something more than just content propagation. What would they do? So it's somehow a loop, a for loop, with a fixed loop bound. And then the GCC would unroll the loop. It would simply replace it by repeating the loop body sufficiently often. Because if you know it's five times, then you can five times, you unroll the loop. Then you have, and then you can kind of do the constant propagation again. And then it makes a completely different story. Because then it is not there's just one program point two, but there are many program point twos. Namely one copy of the program point two for every iteration of the loop. And then you get for every point, you get a different, you simply evaluate it and round robin iteration in one go would evaluate it. Once you have removed the loop. And then you would kind of find out, okay, in the end, the factorial of 10, I don't know what it is, but that would be the value which you write into memory, and then you write that constant. So therefore, GCC does constant propagation like that, but does also other things like more aggressive things like this loop unrolling, and by that, it ultimately can do surprising extra stuff. Okay. So now, but taking just this plain constant propagation, what would be the... So we get all these top values, okay, so that we have now... we have kind of... also it is depressing... We accept it, but the question is, can we get the top values fast? Will it terminate? So one of the most horrible perspectives would be you try to do this analysis and it doesn't terminate. So then you can't use it for your compiler. So will it terminate? So now the question is, yes, it will. And for that, we only have, what do we have to guarantee? We have to guarantee that our complete lattice of values, that you cannot increase values arbitrarily often. And now here it turns out that the round robin iteration will perform a bounded number of rounds. And here the number of rounds is bounded by the number of program points times the number of individual updates which you can make for every program point. How many updates can you do for a particular program point? Well, for every particular program point, you can... how many updates can you do? So in the first round, you provide... you will typically provide a... value for every program variable at a program point. So this gives you the first round. And then in following rounds, the only thing what you can do is to take the values which you have for a variable and set it to top. Or you keep it. So this is the only thing what you can do. So going to top for a variable, you can do at most m times. Yeah? So it is you need one round, this is this n, and then you need, you have for every, in every round you will increase at least one variable. This gives you from a concrete value to top. So this gives you n times m possible rounds. So altogether, you therefore have n times m plus one rounds of round robin iteration, and afterwards you will have a fixed point and have reached the least fixed point. So still, and once again, so this is the least fixed point solution, and now we wonder, is it the same as the MOP, or did we lose extra information? And the problem, the small kind of extra fact is that, oh, too bad, we will not get the merge over all path. So we compared to the merge over all path solution, we still have lost some information. And why is that the case? So that is the case because functions are not transformations at edges are not distributive. And that we could, so now, is it difficult to see that? No, it is very easy. You just take the simplest control flow edge you could imagine, namely this one. You add two values. You add to the values of two variables and assume that in one, along one path, you get that X has the value 2 and Y has the value 3. And on the other path, you have X has the value 3 and Y has the value 2. So clearly, the sum of X and Y in both cases is 5. So if you evaluate first, apply the F first to D1 and to D2, and then take the least upper bound, you will get something that in both cases, in both cases, X will receive the value 5. And Y, okay, Y in one case has the value 3 and in the other case the value 2. So the least upper bound of these two variable assignments will find out nothing about Y, but will find that X has the value 5. So that we can agree. So that's okay. But now if you do the other, do everything in the other way around, that is you first do the least upper bound of D1 and D2. So you do the least upper bound of these two things. And then you see, oh, the X's have different values, so you have to go to top. The Y's have different values, so you have to go to top there also. So the least upper bound of D1 and D2 is top top. And then if you apply F, you will not find out anything. X plus Y then is simply top. Yeah? And so therefore, now you have top in both cases. You lost some information compared to the situation when you evaluated the F individually and did the least upper bound later. So that is, in the, therefore, since these two things are not the same, the green and the yellow one, we conclude that we have no distributivity is violated, and therefore the fixed point solution is different. And in fact, it turns out, I guess people in the 70s have proven that it is even uncomputable to determine the precise. One can construct examples where it is uncomputable to determine the precise merge over all path solution. So that, in that sense, so here at least we see we get something less. And we also see another thing, one might get something better if one delayed the least upper bound as long as possible. Then you are more precise. First doing the least upper bound and then applying the transformations is less precise than doing the transformations first and then doing the least upper bound later. Yeah, so... So ultimately, we therefore have, recall there was this Kildall thing with the equality in case of distributivity, but there was also this Kamm-Ullmann thing, which simply stated that at least we have this approximation. So given, so therefore, the we cannot compute the merge over all path, but we can approximate it, and that's good enough, and that we will do, and that is what people do for constant propagation. Yeah. So in and so here I so in summary we still have whatever happens at in the concrete, whatever state we within whatever state we reach broken point V, this will be described by the value provided by the value provided by the least solution of our constraint system. Okay, and that's sufficient for doing the transformation. And here is the transformation which we might then now do. So the transformation is very easy. If our analysis finds out that the broken point is not reachable, then we simply remove the broken point because we don't need it anymore. And likewise, if we have an edge, so this is typically a guard, and this guard, the transformation of that edge is returns bottom, then this means that the guard is not taken, and that means I can also remove this edge. Okay, so they throw it away. And the same if and if I have a guard like this one, which is definitely always true. So here, no, sorry, I should not cancel it out. I should highlight it. So if the abstract evaluation of the E definitely finds out zero, then this the other guard will be kind of removed, and this one can therefore simply the edge remains, but we don't need the guard anymore because we know the result already at compile time, and therefore we can replace it with nop. And the same for the on the positive side, if you have a positive guard and this returns a definite value, not top, it returns 1, 2, 3. And 1, 2, 3, so it's neither zero nor top. And then we also know this guard will definitely be taken, and we therefore can replace it with nop. And the other one will definitely not be taken, and therefore this will be simply removed. And so that was this kind of thing. And then if we have an assignment like this one, and the E has a definite, the right-hand side evaluates to some constant, then we can replace the right-hand side simply by the constant. And, so that we can do. Now, if this means, so for example, so that is not completely the end of the story, because that means only that we optimize the way the evaluation of the right-hand side and replace it by a constant. We could, if I have here a subsequent edge, for example here, and then something like y equals x plus 2. Okay, so in that case, that was a bad example, so it should not be 2, but x plus some other variable, say z. Z has an unknown value. But I have found out that the x has the value c. Then I could here also write then y equals c plus z. Yeah? So that is, I remove the use of x, because x has a constant value. And then comes our super duper transformation, which removes assignments to dead variables, and x is dead because it's not used. Its value is constant, so therefore it will never be used everywhere. I only use directly the constant. So therefore, this one will become an assignment to a dead variable and goes away. So again, you see here that this seemingly stupid optimization of removing assignments to dead variables is subsequently applied to constant propagation, a valuable transformation which may remove some variables. Yeah, and for that, one would kind of extend that transformation so that whenever I have values of variables at hand, like here, then I can optimize every expression which is encountered by replacing variables with their constant values. So here in that case, I would replace y with the value 5. Okay, so that actually, so now when I say syntactically, so these transformations are always, when I do a program transformation, the optimizations are kind of syntactical. I remove something at an edge. I replace a variable with a value. And then here, that means here in the intermediate step, I would arrive at an expression x plus, and here, since it is extremely syntactical, I have this opening bracket, I have the 3, I have the multiplication, and I have the 5, and I have the closing bracket. So I have such thing. And now, again, you see there is a stupid thing here. I have a sub-expression which is simply constant, like that. And then I could kind of evaluate that also and replace it with a single constant. I could make that a little bit systematic in taking sub-expressions and trying to evaluate the sub-expressions with respect to my abstract variable assignment. And whenever I get a constant value, I take that constant value directly. So here, 3 times y evaluated with respect to this d gives the value 15, and then I use the 15 and not directly. That I could do. So I use the abstract expression evaluation to improve expressions. So when that allows me to replace a sub-expression by a value, then I do it. And otherwise, if there's top for the sub-expression, I can't optimize the sub-expression away. That would be the idea here. And since x is unknown, x plus 15 is also top, and therefore I cannot remove the x plus 15. But please note that with numbers, there are a lot of other rules which we have not yet really considered. And that is, for example, that you can rewrite expressions further by taking other laws into account. For example, you could say x times 0 is 0, x times 1 is x plus 0 is x, and x minus 0 is x. Such kind of optimizations rules you could also apply all the time to simplify expressions. And that is useful. I don't know who of you has attended my course on virtual machines. There, we looked at code generation schemes, where we kind of had we created, for example, address expressions recursively on the structure of types. So, for example, if you have an array of ints, then you kind of, and you access the ith element, then you take the I, you scale it with the size of the element types, and you add it to the base address. Now, if and you could have more complicated expressions, and some parts of it were constants, and sometimes they were simply one, and then you have one times something, or zero plus something, and all these kind of annoying extra cases led to annoying code which one created, and then one looked at the code and said, yes, it is the application of our code generation scheme, but it looks completely stupid, and one would like to do such kind of simplifications. But that would do the compiler anyway. So the compiler therefore would think, so you should think of that the compiler will generate quite schematically the code, and then comes this optimization phase and removes all these stupid arithmetic operations. Okay. So that was the base setting of constant propagation. Is there a question for that? Now comes a little bit of an extension of it, a further extension. Namely, we take a second look at conditions, how we dealt with conditions. So what did we do so far? So far we said, okay, we check whether this condition is true, whether we can evaluate at compile time, and if so, we throw it away. So that was kind of our... So if we know that x is 7, then we replace this guard with the if. We remove the if. That's it. But in most in many cases, it might be the case that we cannot find out whether x really is 7 or not. And in that case, we would currently do nothing, because x then is top, and top, the question of top is equal to 7. That can be true or false. So we take the, we leave the guard as is and do nothing. But that's not the best what we can do, because at that particular point, whenever we reach it, we have more information. Because at that point we know x must be 7. Otherwise we would not reach that program point. Now if x is 7 at that program point, so this means it was top before the guard, but then we go into the guard, after the guard, the value of x, the concrete value of x has not changed, but our information about x has changed. So the abstract value drops to from top to 7 for x. So we extract information from the guard and then can do optimization here. Because at that point we know x must be 7, so we can replace it by 10. And that's kind of a significant thing. Because, well, in that case it's just one addition which we save, but at least we can do something. So it's not so that we can't do anything anymore. Yeah, even if the value of x in principle is unknown, but as soon as the guard is taken, we have learned something about the value of x. And that means we can improve our transformation in such a way. So let us look at this situation. We have x equals e and as a guard, and now the guard is on the positive side. So we check whether x is equal to e. So if we can determine that at compile time, okay, so then we know that x has the value of e, and we need not do anything. And if we know that x is different from that e definitely, so that it returns the value 0, then also it's fine, then we will return bottom, then this edge will definitely never be taken. But now it could be the intermediate case. And the intermediate case is that we know nothing about x, and therefore also nothing about the value of... we might know nothing about x, or we might know nothing about e. So what we then can do is we take the value of e which we have. We try to evaluate the e, whatever value it is, and we take the greatest lower bound. Because the value of x should meet both. And so therefore it is less or equal to the least upper bound of, to the greatest lower bound of both. And that kind of, by that we improve the value of x. And that is not because something has changed at that x, but our information about x has changed. So, on the negative side we can't do anything, but if we have a negative guard for x is different from e, then we can do the same thing. So now let's look at our example here. So here we would have top. At that program point, we go through the guard, and then we would determine for the new value for x would be the old value of x, this is top, intersected with the value of the right-hand side. And the value of the right-hand side, which we is in this case not top, but 7, so that is, we map x to the meet of top and 7, and this is 7. So therefore we can improve the value of x to 7. And therefore we can optimize that to 10, and therefore in particular we have that y maps to 10 at that program point. When we come to program point 3, to program point 3, then we do the join. Why is X again top there? So I remove all that what I have scribbled. Well, along that path, X has the value 7. But along that path, X still has the value top. And then we take the least upper bound. So here at that point, we have to take the least upper bound of top and 7, and that restores the value top. And that is clearly, that is the only thing what we can, the best what we can do. It's only when the then part is taken that we know that X is 7. But otherwise, we don't know about the values of X. Yeah, so in this sense, it is reasonable that here, at that, where the if the two branches of the if then else come together again, that there we have the value top only. Okay? And that accordingly, now doing this optimization which we have in mind, this means that we can replace X with 7, and that means we can update, write Y equals 10, and on that branch. Yeah, on the other branch, Y may have any other value. So therefore, here we do not know anything about the Y. Okay. Any questions? So now comes the Y constant propagation. You might, it was one of these transformations where in the beginning you might think this is a stupid optimization. It is rarely that we write a constant. Then I try to argue that constants are kind of a design pattern, if you like, for programmers, which is very, well, if it is not frequent, that at least it is useful, and we want our compiler to provide constant propagation for us so that we can use these implementation patterns, like using flags for switching on and off program features. So that we would like to have. But now comes another analysis, which is, if you like, a generalization of constant propagation. And this applies to the situation, to the perhaps now normal situation, that values of variables may change. Now, the goal of interval analysis is to determine for every unknown, if not the value, so at least a tight interval where all the values are in. So why do we need such kind of information? Where is it useful for? Why is it important to know that, for example, an index I is in the range of, say, 0 and 41? Once again, you say if I have an if where this I is checked, then I may get information whether the check is satisfied or not. Okay, so but why should that be, that seems a little bit artificial. Is there a very good reason why we would like to have such kind of interval analysis in our compiler? So a very good reason is, think of array-bound checks, and in particular or buffer overruns in C. So I think one of the key vulnerabilities of most software systems around is based on buffer overruns. And that is that somebody has forgotten, for efficiency reasons, to check whether something... Yeah, you have a buffer, you iterate over it and write something into it, and you do not check whether the size of the buffer matches the iteration. Things like that, kind of. So it's a programming error, and it's a security vulnerability of many systems. So, and for that reason, Java, for example, has built-in array-bound checks. So whenever you allocate an array of a particular size, then the runtime system will have to check whether every access is within the bounds. And that is extremely annoying, and that is extremely costly, because this means every access to the array will be enclosed in a conditional, like one which you kind of described, where the I is checked again, is it in the range between 0 and less than 42? And that is kind of for every access. So that is kind of stupid, because if you have checked it once, then it should be good for all other accesses also. Or this is one thing, or if we have, if we know the size of the array is 42, and then we can infer that it will be all, so that it always is the case. Yeah. And the iteration runs from 0 to 41, then we know that all the accesses will be inside the array. So that is, we would like to have to check statically that in accesses to arrays are not out of bounds, and that for that we need an interval analysis. So here is the little example which does that. So assume we have this array. We have an iteration going from 0 to 41, and we have this access to the array, which is here, with an index I. So here I made it simple. I simply kind of assume that all the elements in the array may have size 1 or so. So at least, so there is this, so here, and therefore the addresses I compute are just base address plus I, and I write something into it, and what could I write in this little program? So I write I into it. I should write perhaps something reasonable, but I didn't have an idea what to write there, so I wrote I simply. Yes, you can do that. And now if it is really an intermediate code for Java, then you would kind of enclose this access to the address to the array by an array bound check. So you check whether this index is a legal index and that it is within this, and otherwise you would kind of throw an exception. Yeah, and now we have this, so now what would we do as humans? So we don't know about arrays and how large they are. But we see, okay, so there is here this 42 and there's this 0, and here's also the 0 and here's also the 42. So the for loop already is inside, always inside, and so this I check, so it's a kind of a second check of the same thing. So, and therefore I would kind of say we don't need it. And now we would like to have a mechanical mechanization of such kind of reasoning. So, and now what can we do? And we try to do always the same. So what we have learned, we try to apply. Now, constant propagation would not work because I is not constant. So we would like to, and the values which we would like to keep track is not whether it is 5 or top, but we would like to, we would do the next best thing that we could, we would like do, we would like to maintain for every program variable X an interval. And that interval could be larger or smaller. So that would be kind of the idea. So that is, we do, we simply take the argument which we had for constant propagation and only exchange the value domain. It's no longer integers plus top, but intervals. So now, what is an interval for me? An interval is simply a pair of numbers, and the lower number should be less or equal to the upper number. There are only two kind of extra special things that maybe we don't know a lower bound for the values. Then we have minus infinity. or we do not know an upper bound to the values, then the upper bound should be plus infinity. So this could be minus infinity, and that could be plus infinity. So the u could not be minus infinity, because that's not possible. But and the l, the lower bound plus infinity, is also kind of not really realistic. So in that sense, the l is from there, and the u is from there. L for lower bound, u for upper bound. Okay? So that's it. And so this is our value domain. And so what is the largest value? Is there a largest value in that? So first, when I say largest value, we should kind of agree that that these values are partially ordered. And you can kind of bound that. So what is the partial ordering? Okay, so one interval is less or equal to another interval if the elements in it are included. So it's kind of set inclusion. And you can, and in order to kind of compute it, when you do not want to enumerate all the elements of one interval and check whether each of the values is contained in the other interval, it suffices to check the bounds. To check the bounds, and that means the smaller interval has a larger lower bound and a smaller upper bound. So lower bounds and upper bounds behave differently. So the upper, if less or equal for intervals, means that the upper bounds are less or equal, and for the lower bounds you have to revert the ordering. Okay? But it's no longer a linear ordering in that sense. So because the two intervals very well could be incomparable, because they might overlap, or they might be disjoint even, and then you cannot say one is larger or smaller than the other. Therefore, it is a partial ordering, and no linear ordering. Okay, so now again, my question: is there a largest element? The largest element. What we have to denote, so every element is a pair. So we have to write something down there in the left side under for L, and we have to write something for U. What should I put for L?
Minus.
Infinity, and for the other one, plus infinity. So this is the largest element. So there is a largest element. So that's good news. When we know nothing about a variable, we can always return that. So that's good. Is there a smallest value? So I assume that the lower bound is always less or equal to the upper bound. So this, a minimal value, so to speak, is somehow 5,5. That would be a minimal value. Yeah, because that would be a one element interval. So there are also empty intervals, if you like, but that I have not included here. So there's no least element. So 5,5 is a minimal one. 6,6 is another minimal one. So there are many minimal intervals, but there is no least minimal interval. And okay. And now the question. Then the question is: is there? That is. So we have. Therefore, this the set of intervals is, as we define it here, only a partial ordering, not a complete lattice, because there is no least element. But we still have something like a least upper bound of two things. What is the least upper bound of two intervals? So the least upper bound of two intervals is, I take the minimal least upper bound and the maximal greatest. The minimal lower bound and the maximal upper bound. Sorry, that is the way how I do it. So again, for the lower bounds, I have to take, everything is kind of turned upside down. I have to take the minimum and for the upper bounds I have to take the maximum. And there's also something like an intersection, but since there is, this is not always defined. So only intersection is only defined if they overlap. If they do not overlap, the intersection would be empty. But we do not have empty intervals. So therefore, intersection is a partial operation. But the partial operation is, if it is defined, you take the least upper bound of the lower bounds and the minimum of the upper bounds. And that gives you the intersection. And it is only, it is defined if this inclusion here holds. Okay, so that in this sense we note that the intervals, as we have, since we did not have no empty set, so if I added empty set, then we would have a complete lattice, but without empty set we have not a complete lattice. And so that is one thing, and we can use it, still this is only the value domain, and the abstract states then would be mappings from variables to intervals or bottom. So, and then we have a least element and then everything is fine. So in that sense, it is not a complete lattice, but it's not a problem for us. At least we have this least upper bound thing and we can compute with it. So this is on the good side. So this is not harmful. But there is another thing which is a little bit of, gives us a little bit of a headache, that intervals may arbitrarily grow. So now, if we build into our abstract states intervals, then we could have states and larger states and larger states and ever-growing states, simply by assigning to variables larger and larger and larger intervals. So this is now a new phenomenon. So suddenly we realize that what we did for constant propagation may try to do it here, but our fixed point algorithm, about which we were so proud and it works in all the cases, suddenly may not work anymore because there are these infinite ascending chains. And this is again a little bit we are annoyed about it, that what we did does not always work, but it is also good for me, because otherwise I would not have to teach you anything. So there's still something more. So we need extra tricks. So there's extra things to learn. And so this makes it a little bit more interesting. Otherwise, if you knew everything already, then everything is boring. So we need now extra tricks how to deal with these ascending chains. Yeah? So, but for the moment, this is about this solving these constraint systems. For the moment, we just ignore it, because we first ignore our problems and then later we solve them. But for the moment, we just want to get the rest in right, and that means we want to know how can I do construct my abstract states, how can I do addition and multiplication and things like that if I compute with intervals instead of numbers. So these are the things which we have to kind of fiddle out and nail down, and then we can, once we have done that, we have an interval analysis, and then we need some extra technique to deal with this infinite ascending chains. So first of all, we kind of, when we have these intervals, we kind of may agree upon what it means for a number like 42 to be described by an interval. Because we had this description relation, this was, for the analysis it was, we didn't need it, but for the correctness of the analysis, or at least it kind of formalizes what kind of information we may expect or extract from the values returned by our analysis. So so let us make a very stupid example. If we have if this is the interval our analysis this returns for a variable x, what kind of information can we extract from it? So we hope to extract from it that then x has one of the values in the interval, that is a value 1, 2, 3 to 17. Okay? So accordingly here, this is what we kind of here formalize. A number is described by such an interval L, U if Z is inside the interval or L is less or equal to Z less or equal to U. That's what we expect, and that is, I wrote it down. And accordingly, this means if I have this kind of interval and I want to know what values are described by it, I take all the values in between. Okay, and here are these examples. The only this one I have kind of scribbled on the last, more or less, on the last slide. Now, it might be also interesting, so if I have infinity as the upper bound, then this means there is no upper bound, that is, I get all numbers, starting from the lower bound. Okay, so this is now the gamma, the concretization of an abstract value. Now let's see whether we can, how we can compute. So that was the next. So everything in this constant propagation business was, once we have the description relation for the values, was more or less mechanical, up to the point where we did replaced the arithmetic operators from the concrete world with the corresponding operators in the abstract world. So in the abstract, we have not numbers but intervals. So instead of plus, we now need a plus for intervals. How can we define plus for intervals? So the idea is, the result should be an interval which contains all the values which I may obtain by adding elements from one interval to elements from the other interval. So that is kind of the specification which we must meet. And how does this interval look like? For plus, this is very easy. We simply have to kind of add the lower bounds and add the upper bounds. And then we get another interval which holds exactly the values from the when I add the from the other two argument intervals. And the only we have to think about what happens if one of the arguments is plus or minus infinity, but that kind of survives. If there's minus infinity plus 5, then this is minus infinity, and likewise plus infinity plus 5 is still plus infinity. Okay? And this one cannot occur because we never add a lower bound to an upper bound. We only add lower bounds or upper bounds. And therefore, never minus infinity comes together with plus infinity. Okay, so plus is easy. Now what about minus? Minus for intervals is... So you have to take minus of the bounds. But a little bit more. You have also to exchange the bounds. So maybe I write it here. If you have 1, 5... then minus of it is, well, so here this is a 1. It is, the bounds are minus 5 and 1 and minus 1, but minus 5 is less or equal than minus 1. So this is this, and if you like, anti-monotonicity of minus. So you really have to exchange the upper and the lower bounds. So that is a little bit, this is again a little bit of interesting, so that it's not just putting the minus inside, but also exchanging the bounds. And then it comes for multiplication, and so if I have two intervals and I want to I want to have an interval containing all the products, then it's not so easy. For example, it depends because, and that is, multiplication is awkward with respect to signs. So if I have just positive arguments, then it suffices to multiply the lower bounds and multiply the upper bounds, and then the product of the upper bounds will give the upper bound, and the same for the lower bounds. That's fine. If you have mixed negative and positive values, then weird things can happen. And so in the end, you obtain an interval containing all the values by taking all possible products and taking the least value among these to get the lower bound, and taking the greatest value of all these products, and that gives you the upper bound. For example, in this particular situation, the lower bound is obtained by multiplying this upper bound with that lower bound. This is the least value which you might obtain. And the upper bound is obtained how? By multiplying this lower bound with that lower bound. So you see, it's strange. At least it's not so obvious to find a better possibility as taking all products and taking the minimum or maximum of the resulting values. We have taken a closer look. There is a possibility to improve on that, but a little bit only. Okay? And then there is a thing with division. The problem is what is if there is zero in the interval or not. For the argument you cannot exclude that there is zero, then it's a little bit strange. So what should you do then? If it were zero, then there would be a potential runtime error, and the question is what happens at the runtime error for the system. It could explode, it could the CPU might melt down, or program may stop, or simply continue and do nothing. I don't know. So it depends on what the programming language semantics says in that situation. Here, in that case, we are Solomonic and say that the result is anything. You might do it a little bit better. You might think of it as you could instead, I don't know whether that will help in many cases, but you could also instead do do the same as use define A, B as the L1, U1 divided by L2 minus 1, least upper bound L1 U1 plus 1 U2. Yeah, you separate the interval into two intervals not containing the zero, and then do the division, and then take the least upper bound of the two. So that would be something which you could also do. And in some cases, this might, if you kind of consider optimize only for correct computations. That you could do instead of setting the result to top. Okay, so that was for the arithmetic. So maybe but there are more operators which are of interest for evaluating expressions, because also conditions are expressions. So, and conditions typically will contain comparison operators, and that is now interesting. What do you do at comparison operators with when you have intervals for the values of the arguments of the operator? So, for example, if you check for equality. So it is an instructive exercise to wonder what should the result be. So in the concrete, you have two expressions, and you ask, are they equal? And now the abstract evaluation will return for the one expression an interval, and for the other expression an interval. And now you have to determine, given these two intervals, what are the possible values for the returned by the equality operator. So there are three possible outcomes. Either it is always 1, or it is always 0, or it is 1 or 0. So this gives us these three intervals as potential outputs. So there's never top, it's always an interval, but it's not necessarily in a one element interval. Okay? Now we may ask, when will it be the case, under which conditions will it be the case, that the two values will definitely be equal? So I write down immediately an example, 1,2. So the intervals are the same. But still, in this situation, we will have to return the value 0,1. Why? Why? Because we do not know at runtime which value from that interval will be taken. It could be 2. And we will not know which value will be taken from that interval. It could be 1. And 2 is different from 1. So therefore, 0 is a legal output. And also it could be the same. It might be the same that the same values are taken from both intervals. In that case, 1 would be the result. So we cannot know, just having the interval information, which will be the result. So therefore we have to, in this case, we will have to put 0,1 into the as the result interval for the abstract equality operator. You see it? So this is, you see what I can try to, you see my message? Is there a question? So now we might wonder under which conditions we can be sure that the result for the concrete values will always be true. Well, if there's only one value here and one value there, there's no choice. So in this case, definitely, they will be the same. So therefore, in this situation, we will return 1. And that is kind of formalized here. So if the lower bounds and the upper bounds are all the same, then we can be sure that they are the same, and then we return the interval 1. And likewise, now when do we know that the two intervals are definitely different? So that it need not be the case that they are one element. The only thing is, if they do not overlap, then we know whatever choice we have from the one interval and whatever choice from the other, these values will never be the same. So we definitely return 0 if the intervals do not overlap. And I hope I have formalized that here. So this means that either the upper bound of one is smaller than the lower bound of the other, or vice versa. Yeah? So in that sense, so now I hope you understand. You have seen the basic concept, what kind of argument you have to apply to construct these abstract evaluation operators. So here are the results. Some examples. Here definitely the intervals do not overlap, so therefore we return 0. Here these intervals are one element and the same, so therefore we return 1. And in all other cases we do not know. Now for the less, when can we say, so that the argument will be now always the same, when will we say that, can we say that this interval should be less than that interval with respect to this abstract operation? And then it's clear, so it should be that one interval should be kind of to the left of the other interval. In that case, we can be sure that every element here will be definitely less than every element here. So that is, we have to compare the upper bound, this U1, with the lower bound here. And if it's less than this lower bound, then we can say, yes, it is always, we will have 1. True. And if U2, if it's the other way around, if the U2, this one, is less or equal to this L1, then we know it definitely is less or equal. So that is the negative thing. And otherwise, we cannot be sure. Here are three examples for that. In that case, all elements herein are less or equal to these, so therefore we have one. And here we simply don't know, because we could choose seven from the left argument and zero from the second, and then they are definitely will not be less. So therefore we have to return zero or one. And likewise here, in this situation, we can be sure that 1, 2 is definitely not greater than 3, 4. And therefore we return 0. So that kind of gave us a little bit of intuition how we can deal not only with addition but also with these comparison operators. And we will continue to construct this interval analysis next time. Thank you for your attention.